Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Not too long before the pseudo-religious organization known as the People's Temple moved to the remote jungles of Guyana in the northwest corner of South America, where over 900 people killed themselves at the behest of their so-called leader, Jim Jones, in 1978. They were based in Redwood Valley, California, about 10 miles from Ukiah, the home of Radio Curious. In this, the second Radio Curious conversation with Shankar Vedantam, author of The Human Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives, we explore what compelled these people to kill themselves. We'll examine what compels suicide bombers of the early 21st century to take their own lives and those of others. And are we, in fact, all susceptible to these ideas? Shankar Vedantam is a national correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post and a 2009-2010 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. This conversation with Shankar Vedantam was recorded from his home in Massachusetts on May 17, 2010, and began when I asked him to explain the attraction of cults. Who are drawn to them and why?
When we think about terrorist groups, we tend to think about suicide terrorists as being people who are aberrational, people who are doing bizarre things, incomprehensible things, people who believe in absurd fantasies about the afterlife and the rewards they will get for carrying out suicidal missions in the here and now. In the last 10 years or so, there has been a much more systematic study of people who become suicide terrorists, largely centering on people who do not succeed in carrying out their missions, are apprehended, and then find themselves imprisoned. And detailed studies of these individuals, detailed psychological studies of these individuals, combined with comprehensive databases about people who actually carry out and complete suicide attacks, show that many of our beliefs about suicide terrorists turns out to be wrong, that they are intuitively plausible, but they do not turn out to be supported by the evidence. What we conventionally think about suicide terrorists, for example, is we think of them as being fanatical and crazy religious bigots. We think of them as being poor or disenfranchised and, you know, eager to sign up for any plot that would give their family some money. We think of them as being, you know, young, sex-starved people who are ready to believe fantasies or, you know, ludicrous stories about sleeping with multiple virgins in the afterlife and so on. It turns out all of these things are quite untrue. Large numbers of suicide terrorists turn out not to be religious at all. Some of them turn out to be secular, even atheists. The vast majority of suicide terrorist attacks in recent years have been carried out by people who are married and who have children. These are not sex-starved adolescents. And finally, many of these people are not drawn from the ranks of the underemployed, the unemployed, you know, the chronic drifters in society, but they often come from privileged parts of society. And if you look at sort of some of the recent terrorist attacks or would-be terrorist attacks, the Christmas Day bomber, for example, or the guy who tried to set off the bomb in Times Square recently, and not to say anything about Osama bin Laden and his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri, none of these people come from backgrounds of poverty. You know, all of them are privileged in one way or the other. Many of them are high educated or even highly educated. And so our conventional model of who suicide terrorists are turns out to be wrong. The question that I try and ask in The Hidden Brain is what does link these people together? And the argument that I make is that the process by which people become suicide bombers in different countries and in different contexts is largely similar to other examples of suicide bombers. And so when you look at what happened to the Japanese in the closing days of World War II when they were training kamikaze bombers, when you look at the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers in the 1980s, if you look at the jihadi suicide terrorists in multiple theaters of the world today, what you often find is that these men and women have been put through a process which I call a tunnel, where they have been systematically deprived of the contrary and contradictory views that assail most of us every day. So in my everyday life, I get pulled in different directions because I'm a father, because I'm a journalist, because I like different sports games, I want to listen to this kind of music, I want to make some time for books. And these things create disorder in my life because I don't have time to do everything, but I get pulled in different directions. What happens to people who are within this tunnel is that they're essentially cut off from the outside world, sometimes literally. In other words, literally they have no contact with people in the outside world. And all they hear every day, 24 hours a day, is from the same group of people with the same ideas. And when this happens to people, it turns out that over time, this has a very powerful effect on them. And what I try and show within this chapter in The Hidden Brain that looks at suicide terrorism is that I want to show that in some ways, this is a normal part of the brain. The people who are doing these are normal people. If anything, they are more normal than you and I, more idealistic than you and I. But it's the process that turns them into who they are that is monstrous.
So you describe terrorists as having much in common with exclusive clubs.
Yeah, so one of the questions that people have struggled with as they've tried to understand terrorist groups is why it is that people within these groups very rarely betray their leaders. This is true of, you know, Jim Jones and People's Temple that led to the catastrophic deaths of nearly 1,000 Americans in this utopian outpost called Jonestown about 3 decades ago. But it's also true if you look at Al-Qaeda and terrorist outfits like Al-Qaeda. You very rarely have people betray the people who are at the top of these groups. And the question is, why do they not do so when they would stand to profit enormously from betraying their leaders? And two researchers, Eli Berman and I think it's David Layton, came up with an idea that in many ways these groups function like exclusive clubs. And exclusive clubs are different than garden variety associations, which anyone can join. Anyone can sign up for Facebook and anyone can sign up for Twitter, but not everyone can get into their local country club. You actually have to know someone. You have to have connections. Some clubs limit membership to people whose parents or grandparents were once members of the club. Many of these clubs have very expensive dues, making it very hard to stay in the club. And what this process does of making it very difficult for people to join a group is it essentially weeds out everyone who is not dead serious about being a member of the group. And so essentially what happens within these groups is that they become self-selecting for the kinds of individuals who are likely to be most loyal to the leaders of these groups.
So let's focus on the People's Temple and what happened there. People gave up all of their assets, gave everything to Jim Jones and the People's Temple, and some chose to move with him to the end of their lives in Guyana. And some of those who killed themselves believed that they were doing the right thing.
That's right. I think what's striking about Jim Jones and People's Temple, as is the case with many other groups that you know, that we sort of call terrorist groups today, is how much of the group was formed on a core of idealism. People's Temple and Jim Jones would not have existed if America was not as racially divided as it was in the 1960s and 1970s. And so Jim Jones was able to persuade young idealistic people in California especially, but also in many other parts of the world, many other parts of the country, that what he was doing was waging this noble cause, that he was waging an idealistic cause. And the problem was the cause actually was idealistic. The cause of racial integration, of racial fairness and equity, was and is a noble cause. And this attracted large numbers of people to his fold, people who came from often wealthy and privileged backgrounds who said, you know, I can't just stand by while this injustice is being perpetrated in my country, and here's this charismatic pastor who says he knows how I can help fix that problem, and I want to be a part of that solution. And so many, many people signed up to join People's Temple. Eventually what happened is the process within the temple came to resemble this tunnel that I've just described, where people who didn't have these fervently held beliefs about Jim Jones himself and their mission left the temple, so that the group that remained within the temple was ever more similar in outlook, personality, temperament, and views. Many of these people followed Jim Jones when he decamped to Guyana. I think this might have been in 1977, and about a year later, after Jones feared that his plans had been exposed and U.S. authorities were about to intervene, nearly 1,000 Americans committed suicide.
And much of that you characterize in other terms as status and belonging, which is something that I observe most everybody wanting, exhibiting it in different styles, whether it's labeled clothing or fancy cars or association memberships.
I think people do care intensely about status and, you know, how they're perceived by others. I think this probably is something that is evolutionarily hardwired into us. The fact that we care intensely about the views of those around us plays a very normal and healthy part in most of our lives, that, you know, it helps us follow norms of social behavior, it helps us be considerate of others, decently, generously toward others. But I think it can also be manipulated by people, you know, not just in terms of crass materialistic goals, although it's that too. So the investment bankers who are working, you know, 85 hours a week because they want to, you know, own a home in Martha's Vineyard are part of sort of what is essentially a cult. I mean, they all subscribe to this belief that the house in Martha's Vineyard is worth the 85 hours and not having a family life and trampling on other people. And so, you know, this is a bit of a stereotype, I suppose. But they essentially go along with it because they've bought into this idea that this house on Martha's Vineyard is sort of worth all this. Now, the same goes for people who follow very idealistic causes. And in some ways, you could argue it's even stronger for people who have very idealistic causes. Because if I came up to you, Barry, in the 1960s and said, you know, you, Barry, could end racial discrimination in America, wouldn't you want to do that? The allure of that for someone who sort of wants to feel he or she is part of a cause or wants to feel that he or she is going to leave something of value behind in the world when they're gone is extraordinary.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Shankar Vedantam, author of The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elects Presidents, Controls Markets, Wages War, and Saves Our Lives. Shankar, you have a section that you call the illusory correlation. When two unusual events occur at the same time, the hidden brain subtly links the two, even though they have nothing to do with each other.
You can see actually why, in an evolutionary sense, this makes complete sense. Let me give you an example. If you happen to be wandering by a water hole, you know, in the ancestral environment tens of thousands of years ago, and there was a little bush behind which you saw a poisonous snake, your hidden brain basically will come to associate that bush with that poisonous snake the next time you're at that water hole. And it's not necessarily rational because, of course, a snake has no reason to necessarily stay behind that bush, but it's also plausible that that happens to be the snake's home. And so your brain is not doing something wrong by associating that bush with the snake.
It's also not investigating the circumstances where the snake is.
Yes, it's not examining the circumstances where the snake is, but much of what the hidden brain does is that's actually a very dumb system. It's not a sophisticated system. It's a rough and ready system that was designed not just to help humans, but all the animals that came before humans. And so our minds are very adept at making these connections between unusual things. So in a more trivial context and in a more modern context, if you have two different days when you're running to catch an airplane, for example, you're trying to get to the airport to catch a flight, and on both those mornings you happen to have stomach upsets, your hidden brain will quickly associate taking flights with having stomach upsets. And it's very possible or plausible that the next time you have a flight, your hidden brain will prompt you to have a stomach upset. So the underlying idea of an illusory correlation is that when two unusual things happen at the same time, there's something in our minds that say, well, both those things, unusual things, couldn't have happened at the same time. It can't just be a coincidence. There must be something about the one thing that's causing the other thing. The reason I write about illusory correlations in my book is often in the context of prejudice. So when we look at, for example, crime tends to be a very rare event. I mean, we watch large numbers of crime reportage on television news, but the truth is that crime is very rare. I mean, most of us have not been victims of violent crime, or if we have, you know, we can count the instances where we have been such victims on the fingers of one hand. Our minds, however, come to associate certain groups of people with being more criminal than others, partly because the numbers of people in a community tend to be different. So if you have a minority group, and you have a violent crime occur, what happens is that these are both unusual events. These are both aberrational events that are happening at the same time. Our minds link these two events together, which is why most people in America believe that African Americans are far more violent than they actually are. when they hear about a violent crime, they are apt to believe that the criminal was likely an African-American, usually an African-American man, and not a white man, even though the majority of violent crimes are not committed by African-American men. And so it's an example of how a perfectly mundane kind of bias in our brains that may have evolved for perfectly good reasons falls apart when it's applied to our modern world, where we are asked to make much more sophisticated judgments about individuals and not sort of fall back on this kind of sloppy associative thinking.
Let's switch our point here for a moment, if we may, and talk about what may be a correlation that is specific but is ignored. And that's your discussion of suicide among police officers.
This is the final chapter of The Hidden Brain, where I spend a lot of time thinking about how and why human beings make judgments about risk that turn out to be completely unfounded. So most of us are extremely worried about violent crime. Most of us are worried about being assaulted on the street or being mugged or having our houses broken into, when it turns out these are actually extremely rare events. And what I do in this final chapter of The Hidden Brain, I look at the phenomenon of suicide among police officers as a way to talk about how these are men and women who put their lives at risk every day by actually coming into contact with bad people and violent people on a daily basis. And if you were to ask yourself, which is more dangerous, the violent crime that police officers may fall victim to on the street or the risk of suicide, police officers taking their own lives, many people may guess that the street will claim the lives of more police officers. It turns out this is wrong. Suicide claims many, many more lives of cops than do violent criminals, gangs, rapists, muggers, all the bad people we find on our street. And it's a small indication of how we tend to undercount certain risks and vastly inflate other risks in our mind.
Yet that's ignored. And you give the example of a public health officer draining ponds where mosquitoes, being the vector of malaria, are bred. But there's no discussion about having police officers leave their gun at the station when they go off duty.
Right. So one of the public health officials who has actually done this analysis about cops used to be a cop himself. His name is John Violante. He came up with a very simple theory, but he knows that from being a cop himself, the idea would never fly, which is have police officers check their guns at the station when they leave work every day so that they're not carrying their guns home, because the vast majority of police suicides are carried out with weapons that are service weapons. The problem is that when we think about these risks intuitively, certain risks seem much larger to us than other risks, and the risks that other people pose us seem significantly greater to our hidden brains than the risks that we pose ourselves. And so people will go to a movie about Hannibal Lecter and will fear psychopaths and serial murderers for the next several weeks, but they won't fear the fact that they're taking the elevator up and down their buildings and not climbing their stairs and getting enough aerobic activity, because the risk of heart disease seems remote and abstract compared to the risk of a serial killer or a psychopath. It's exactly the same with violent crime and suicide. We fear the mugger and the murderer and the person who breaks into our home, but we don't fear what happens, what we might do ourselves in a moment of depression or sadness, or something goes wrong with our lives, we lose a job, we lose a marriage, and we happen to have a gun at home, and we have easy access to taking our own lives. When we think about these risks, the risk that we pose ourselves via suicide seems small, remote, and abstract compared to the risks that other people pose us. And so when you ask police officers to check their guns at the police station when they leave work, their minds are thinking only about the criminals who are going to break into their homes and that they need a gun to defend against. They're not thinking about their 15-year-old kid who finds the gun and shoots himself in a moment of adolescent peak.
Although we are able to believe that there is a criminal behind every shadow in some urban areas, the other side of that is that if we're asked to donate money or recognize a disaster in Darfur, for instance, where so many people have died to famine, it's much harder to raise money than it is for a single person.
Indeed. So the final chapter of the book looks at the problem that the mind has with both very small numbers and very large numbers. And what we've been talking about the last couple of minutes have been the issue of small numbers, which is how we think about risk, the risk of suicide versus the risk of being mugged on the street. They're both very small risks, but it turns out they are very different risks, and our inability to make accurate distinctions between different kinds of risks leads to all kinds of policy problems. The question you're just asking now has to do with our inability to process numbers that are large. And this shows up especially clearly when it comes to disasters, tragedies involving mass suffering. You would think at an intuitive level that human beings would be much more saddened by a story of mass disaster if I tell you 1,000 people were killed in an earthquake compared to a detailed story about a single individual who has suffered or who has died. But it turns out that our heartstrings are pulled much more effectively by the story of the individual and not by the story of the mass suffering. And that's why you have this very paradoxical situation where you have people, Americans, for example, who are extraordinarily generous when it comes to helping their fellow man and their fellow neighbor, but very often the country has turned a blind eye on mass suffering that's unfolding in other parts of the world, Darfur being a very good example, but Rwanda a few years earlier. You have many, many examples of these sort of mass tragedies unfolding in different parts of the world. You know, we cluck our tongues and say we really wish that, you know, a Holocaust wasn't taking place, but we don't do as much to stop it as we actually could. I have the feeling that much of it has to do with this inability to process the meaning of large numbers. You know, Joseph Stalin said, I think, half a century ago that one death was a tragedy and a million deaths are a statistic. And that idea is really the central core of what I'm trying to write about in the final chapter of The Hidden Brain, why it is that we care more about the single life.
I wonder if going back several hundred thousand years or even 500 years or less in the small communities within which our ancestors lived, we knew about a single death or perhaps two or three deaths, but we didn't know about the people who were destroyed or killed through an earthquake or a tidal wave in the other part of the world, which we now know in an instant as a result of the communication skills that we're using now to talk with each other.
Indeed. And, you know, if you think about it, that's only about 50 or 60 years old, or that we would even be aware of a disaster unfolding in another part of the world. So in some ways, our systems of empathy haven't had a chance to catch up with our technology. The reason why the mind sort of is focused on the good of the few rather than the good of the many, you know, there could be multiple explanations for it. I don't disagree with the explanation you're offering. In The Hidden Brain, I offer another explanation, which is that we are programmed by evolution to care very intensely about our own offspring. That if we had to make a choice between protecting and saving our child versus many other children, you know, we are biased to protecting our child to the point that, for example, I have a 4-year-old daughter. If I step back and say, you know, I might spend $200 on a birthday party for my daughter on her 5th birthday, but if I send that $200 to a charity group that's immunizing children in some poor part of the world, that same $200 could save the lives of 5 children. And much of what I'm trying to do with The Hidden Brain is asking people to try and think through some of these issues more deliberately, more rationally, not to let their intuition do the thinking for them, but to let reason and rationality in some ways become the voice of our conscience.
I also think in the example that you mention about your daughter's 5th birthday is the ego that each of us possess and how each of us, all 6.5 billion or more of us in the world, see the world evolving around us and our children.
Right. The thing that fascinates me about this is not so much that callousness and apathy can arise from people being callous and apathetic, but that it can arise from people in some ways being excessively loving to those immediately around them. That we are so drawn to the immediate tragedy, to the immediate need of the person who's right next to us, that we forget about things that are more abstract. We trust our intuitions rather than trusting our reason.
And I think that goes back to the illusory correlation that you mentioned, and also to the fact that people who adopt children are as close to the adopted child
Indeed.
As they would be to their birth children.
Biological children, indeed. And I think that's actually, you raise a very good point, which is I think what this shows, that adoptive parents care just as intensely about their children as biological parents, shows us in some ways we can choose how we want to live, whom we wish to love. We can choose how much compassion we wish to show others. And in many ways, these can be deliberate choices. Much of this work looking at what I've called the telescope effect, the fact that our empathy works like a telescope focusing in on the few rather than on the many. Much of that research was done by a psychologist called Paul Slovic at the University of Oregon. In one of the experiments that he conducted, he told volunteers in his laboratory about a little girl in Africa who needed help, and he said, how much would you be willing to give to help this little girl? And the volunteers, you know, were willing to give a certain amount of their money. And then he told the volunteers about this little boy in Africa who needed their help and said, how much would you give? And the volunteers were willing to give about the same amount of money as they were willing to give the little girl. But then he presented both children together and said, here's this little boy and this little girl in Africa, and they really need your help. How much money are you willing to give? And he found that the volunteers were willing to give less to the two children when presented together than when the children were presented individually, one by one. And it's an example of how our compassion fatigue, if you will, sets in when the number of victims rises from one to two. You don't have to get to astronomical numbers to see this phenomenon. And you can see many charities taking cognizance of this phenomenon. And so when you get a pitch from Doctors Without Borders or, you know, other humanitarian agencies, very often they will mention the name of a specific child or victim whom your money can help.
Well, Shankar Vedantam, I want to thank you very much for being with us again for two conversations on Radio Curious. And before we close, is there another book that you could tell us about?
I read another book recently. In some ways, it's a problematic book, but it's a really interesting book that I think bears reading. This was Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, looking at the history of colonialism in Africa. And it's a really complex and interesting book. I think it's actually a much more subtle book than many of its critics have recognized. I would recommend that book again.
Well, Shankar Vedantam, author of The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elects Presidents, Controls Markets, Wages War, and Saves Our Lives. Thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. Shankar Vedantam is the author of The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. He is a national correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post, and a 2009-2010 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. This interview was recorded on May 17, 2010. The book Shankar Vedantam recommends is The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. There are over 380 Radio Curious archive editions on our website at radiocurious.org, where all programs are free to download, copy, share, or rebroadcast as you wish. We'd like you to use the whole program and ask that you give credit to Radio Curious. You may also subscribe to our podcast and receive new programs as they are produced. Click the podcast link at radiocurious.org. If you need a CD in MP3 or WAV format, that can easily be arranged. Radio Curious is produced in our studios in Ukiah, California, where we enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail may be sent to Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Hannah Bird is the assistant producer. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm your host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.